which is solving the flatness constraints. Yesterday we were still concerned with the Gauss constraints. And I told you yesterday what happens if you have a three-valent vertex. With outgoing edges, and in this case, you know, you start with a gauge program with the usual spin network basis. So you have a tensor product. Between these three states based on these edges, and what you do then is that you actually sum over something. You contract these indices, which are transformed under gauge transformations. So this is not an edge. Under gauge transformation at this vertex, you transform these indices. So these indices are contracted with the so-called 3J symbol. And this gives you something which is invariant under gauge transformation at this point, at this vertex. And so this would, you know, sometimes this is called an invariant tensor or an intertwiner or I tried to motivate it yesterday, has actually also norm one in the kinematical inner product. And that comes because if you sum over all the piece, the square, if you take the square and sum over all the piece, you get one. An arrow has two sides, so at some point we will need also incoming edges, and I just tell you the result. If you have two incoming edges and an outcoming edge, then it's a bit more complicated. But one can derive that using basically relations between the matrix elements evaluated at G and minor and G inverse. So it's explained in the script. I just give you the result. And you also sum over the 3J symbol. However, you have minus Q1, minus Q2, P3 here, and you contract not the outer, not this index, but this index here, because that is what transforms here. You know, remember that this would be the N index, N1, and this is the M index. M1, and this is the N index. here. So you contract the second index and not the third. And then you have funny signs. And you sum over Q1, Q2, and P3. You know, these signs, these kind of signs appear all the time in your in angular momentum coupling. One needs to be careful to not split this, because these can be half integers. But if you take a sum or difference of two things, which are either both half integers or both integers, you get an integer. And Q is a half integer if J is a half integer. And I told you also yesterday that this vertex corresponds to a triangle. You know, it's basically a dual triangle. There's a general theory of dual triangulations. And it's always oriented positively. So I guess it's this way. And actually, the Gauss constraints tell you that this triangle is closed. So here it's also a triangle, just that the edges of this triangle are oriented the other way around. I hope I did it all in the right order. So this is basically the two invariant vertices for solving the Gauss constraints. And next, you know, we want to glue these vertices together to a closed surface. And the simplest surface, usually the simplest topology one can think of, is a sphere. So let's try to put all the vertices, vertices together so that we get something which looks like a sphere. And we do that in all the smallest, more or less regular possibility to do that is as follows. You know, this is a tetrahedron. I can basically draw it in this way. And I need to orient the edges. So imagine you take this tetrahedron and look onto this tetrahedron from the top. You know, then you see a big triangle, and then you see this as the top of the tetrahedron. So this is just the top view of this tetrahedron, and this is the so-called tetrahedral spin network. And we will use basically this spin network, and I will write you the state which, you know, would be the norm one state of this tetrahedral spin network in a minute. It's just a combination of all these things here. It's a bit boring to write. And so can you guess what happens if you take the dual triangulation of this tetrahedron? So to each vertex, you associate a triangle, and you, to each edge, a transversal edge. One of these very complicated questions. Now, like you do it this way. And then also on the back side. Okay, you can start to count vertices and triangles of a tetrahedron. Four vertices, four triangles. Correct, you get another tetrahedron. So, so you get actually another tetrahedron. I think you have to draw it on for yourself, because if I draw it, you won't see anything. So, so you associate, you know, if you, so this is itself a triangulation, but put a vertex in each triangle, connect these vertices, and then ignore that, you know, you basically don't think three-dimensional, ignore that, take this as a straight edge. And you will find again a tetrahedron. so you see that actually here easier. But you have to have a slight problem, because you have to identify these outer edges, which each other, and you do that actually in this way. And then you have to rotate it around to see that this is again a tetrahedron. Okay, so I will write you this. I will write you just the gauge invariant spin network associated to this tetrahedral network, and it has to be gauge invariant, and it's a bit lengthy. So we have four vertices. For every vertex, we get one of these symbols, 3J symbols. We have one vertex with only outgoing edges, and we have three other vertices where you have two ingoing and one outgoing. So we get three of these things and one of these things. And I will call it something, because we will need it all the time. This will be called the state depends on 4J's. You know, does will not depend on any of these magnetic indices, because they will be all contracted with the 3J symbols. And that is defined as some over P's and Q's running from 1 to 6. I mean, the indices here, 1 P1 to P6 and Q1 to Q6. And then you have the vertex with three outgoing edges. Then you have these minus signs. No, now it's easy to see, you know, every edge which is incoming, every edge which is outgoing is also to some vertex, is incoming with some vertex, some other vertex. And for every incoming thing, you get one minus sign. So you get six minus signs. And that is basically, again, this one, ji minus qi. So these are just all the minus signs. And then here you get these things that you can actually read off. G1, so this is one vertex. I hope I have to write it only once, because it's not extremely interesting. G3, G4, G5, the final vertex, minus Q3, minus Q5, 4, P5. And here you have actually your tensor product of your edge states, and again, if you look at this, you know, this 3N symbol just corresponds to contracting this vertex. And then we have these three others. Okay. So this is actually, this gives you a basis. It's actually a complete basis of all gauge invariant states on this network. You have to be a bit careful. The J's have to satisfy all the triangle inequalities. Otherwise, you get zero. But it gives you a complete basis. And it gives you basically the triangulation of a sphere, in a sense. And what we are going to do in this lecture is to solve the flatness constraints for this set of states. And we are going to compute transition amplitudes between two of such states, and we'll be very happy afterwards. Actually, have to interpret the result at some point. But the result will be open for interpretation for you. So let's move on to the flatness constraints. Flatness constraints, as you remember, were something like that, that the curvature has to vanish. And there was a little exercise. And actually, now it's in the script, the answer to the exercise. In electrodynamics, which is, you know, instead of non-abelian, it's within abelian group U1. If you want to approximate F, which is again a complicated operator, it contains derivative and so on, you can take a small holonomy, gamma, and it turns out now this is defined as the exponential, doesn't need to be ordered, pass ordered, because it's all abelian. So here, so this I can write it with forms, but you know, let me write it in forms. E gamma dot A S D S. So this is for electrodynamics. And one finds that this is given as 1 minus okay, there's a mismatch in minus signs here in my script. So actually, here you find that this is exactly exponential of the curvature. Integrated over the surface S. (clears throat) this would be in the sense of forms. So if you want to approximate the curvature, you can actually take the holonomy. And this is for small surfaces, this is equal to one minus the curvature. So zero curvature means that this holonomy should be one. And at some point there was a homework to show that this holds also for the non-abelian case. And indeed, you know, this part, the approximate part, also holds for the non-abelian case. So what we are going to do is we are going to replace this condition with the condition that gamma, being a closed loop, the holonomy around gamma has to be equal to 1. And this will be our flatness constraint. And again, we are very lucky because, you know, holonomies were basically our basic variables. So the only thing which we have to do is to take holonomies along the edges, along closed loops. So this was homework for the non-abelian case. And for the abelian case, you know, remember that FAB in terms of forms is, for electromagnetism, is just the differential of A. So this is actually Stokes' theorem, which you get here. And otherwise, it's just F mu nu if you take it as an antisymmetric differential of A. You can also show in coordinates that this holds. So it's a version of Stokes' theorem which applies here. Okay. And now we take our tetrahedral spin network. And would basically have to impose that for all loops which we can find, or for all things which we think are two-dimensional little surfaces, we should impose that the corresponding holonomy is equal to 1. So how many loops are there? You know, for tetrahedron, how many sides has the tetrahedron? This is one side. This is one, you know, this is one loop. This is one loop. Are these all loops? Indeed. We have another loop because it would be basically on the back side of the blackboard. If you look on top of that, we have this one. And I have this picture, but I forgot what these loops are. So H1 so this should be H2. This is H4. H1 should be this, I guess. And this is H3. And so you would think that if we, you know, solve flatness, actually we are extremely fortunate because these are, I defined you the holonomy representation. We have to impose basically the delta function on the group of these holonomies. And these are delta functions on the group. Which means that, you know, they're actually kind of infinity if this is equal to the identity. So this is defined as delta function on the group is defined as if you integrate a function over this delta function, you get f of g. If you take f of g equal to 1, you get just f evaluated at 1. So that's why it's like, you know, the R3 delta function in a sense. But there's a difference. It's on the compact group. So we would impose this. We would like to impose all these four delta functions. However, if you do that, you do something wrong. And that you do something wrong is due to a very nice thing, which is actually the integral form of the Bianchi identity. And this is a very nice geometrical idea, which you can again just, you know, sit down and draw pictures. You know, actually it turns out if all of these things are one, so pick any other loop. Pick any loop, I take H4 as this loop, and if three of them one, automatically the last loop will be also equal to one. And how do you see that? If you look at this picture, you see, you know, start for instance here. And you go around here, you go around here. Oh yeah, you start here. So you go around here, you go around here, you go around here. This gives you H2. Then multiply with H3. So you go back here. And you go around here and here. And then you go this way. And up here. So what you see is that for every inner edge here, you go in both directions, and these holonomies will be cancelled if you even just write down all the definitions properly. You see that even in formulas. So these holonomies cancel out, and the only holonomies which are left over are the outer ones. And you have to go once back and forth. So this actually follows from this identity, which you can, you know, if you are not convinced by the picture, just prove by really writing explicitly all these holonomies. out and basically put them together. H1, you have an H3, so you have G1 here, G1 minus 1, so these cancel and so on. It's an easy exercise. But the picture is even nicer, and this is actually the principle. What happens is the so-called the boundary of a boundary is 0. You actually take all the holonomies along a boundary, namely the boundary of a tetrahedron, it's the surface of a tetrahedron, and what is left over would be the boundary of this boundary. But since it's a closed surface, this boundary is 0. And that's why we have here this kind of redundancy of equations. And it's all a bit related to cohomology of surfaces and these things. And it's important if you want to do gauge fixings. But what I need here is that just you need actually to only impose 3 delta functions. Because otherwise, if you use 4 delta functions in your physical inner product, you will get infinity. And that is the same, you have 1 delta function left over. And that is to the same reason as we discussed for the parameterized particle. If you have 2 delta functions which impose the same thing in the inner product, you just get infinity. Okay. So what you would have to, what we would like to compute is, I don't know, what did the tetra? Yeah, let's call it tetra. So I forgot an A there. It's a bit easier to pronounce than tetra. The tetrahedral spin network. And now we want to define the physical inner product between these two things. And the physical inner product was defined as taking a kinematical state, in this case is tetrahedral state, tetrahedral spin network, put the flatness constraints, and we just put these 3 flatness constraints. And apply it to this other state. And use the usual kinematical inner product, and that will be the physical inner product between 2 tetrahedral states projected to the constrained hypersurface. So as you can see from the script, it's kind of a lengthy computation. If I would write everything out, and the result is amazingly simple. So I will try to motivate the result. So this kinematical inner product, you remember, this meant you took this expression, tetra, j prime, then you have these 3 delta functions. You have tetra j. And then you would integrate over all group elements G1 to G6. And it turns out, if you would do it straightforwardly, you would solve for these delta functions. Say you solve for, G4 to G6. And then you are just left with three, integrating over three group elements. You would write everything in representation matrices and have to figure out what are these integrals over representation matrices and so on. But what happens is that these delta functions, they impose flatness. So these tetras, again, you know, I've written it there. So these states are square root of d, the dimension. And here we have the Wigner rotation matrix. So if these tetrahedral spin networks include each six of these representation matrices. So now, you know, these delta functions impose flatness. One solution to the flatness constraints is truly if you put all the g's equal to one. Because then if you compose lots of ones, you get one. Okay. But this is just one solution, and indeed there's just, you know, this would fix three group elements, whereas our delta functions only fix three group elements. So what happens with the other, with the integration over the other group, with the integration over the other three group elements? However, it turns out that these other three integrations, what they do, you can rewrite them just as a gauge action. You know, all other solutions to the flatness constraints can be obtained by our SU2 gauge transformations. And flatness, it's a gauge invariant notion. You know, if we have a closed loop, and they have one vertex here, and say this is a loop H1 here, and if it would gauge transform under say H here, it would be H minus one. You know, but if H1 is one, then the small h times capital H. H minus one is also one. So flatness is a gauge invariant notion. So that's why you get different, you know, all other solutions by actually applying gauge transformations. And indeed, it turns out that in variables you can rewrite the other three group integrations as gauge transformations at these three vertices. And this is basically this playing around with all these definitions which we had before, it would take me in half an hour to write everything at the blackboard. But this is basically what happens. So these is just an integration over gauge orbits. Of our Gauss constraint. You know, but anyway, we started with something with a gauge invariant combination. So what I told you is just applies to the part to the representation matrices. So what I have so far ignored completely is the 3JM symbol, which give you a gauge invariant contraction. So actually, this gauge transformation acting on the spin network don't change the spin network. So you get the same spin network. So you can actually ignore these integrations even over G, because the right-hand side will be just independent of G. So these don't even count. And you can also, you know, you can actually integrate over the gauge orbits if you want. But what happens is that you already started with something gauge invariant, and everything is defined so that it's normalized to one. So you will just get a one out of that. So in the end, we don't need to integrate anything. We can forget about the integrations over these six group elements. And the only thing which we have to do is to set in our group elements that G is equal to 1. So it's an amazing easy exercise to solve the flatness constraints. So we set the GE equal to 1. Now the D's are a representation matrix. This means that the D's they are also equal to 1 on their corresponding representation space. So this means that they are equal to the Kronecker delta, QE, PE. So this can be ignored. So what I have to do is just in this tetrahedral spin network, I have just to set these D's equal to the Kronecker delta. And this is the Kronecker delta QP, and I sum over all QP. So I just lose one summation over, say, the Qs, and I'm left with a summation over the Ps, and I have to set all the Qs equal to Ps. So let me get this down. This, what you get then, is what I told you at the very beginning of our lectures, is a 6J symbol. And that is defined as a sum over, you know, basically what I told you. Yeah. now it's G2. So this you know, the 6J symbol is, if you ignore these dimension factors, is just taking the all these things there and putting Q equal to P and summing over P. Again, it comes from recoupling theory. It's actually, it's a transformation matrix if you couple 4 different spins in 2 different ways. But now, we are ready to give the final results. So I have 2 tetrahedral spin networks. So projector of this one, projector of this one, and we calculated the physical inner product of this one, and we get, I never mentioned that, so all the 3JM symbols are real. So you should actually take, you know, the complex conjugated in the inner product, and you have to do that for the representation matrices. But you can actually choose conventions so that the 3JM symbols are real, and the 6J symbol will be also real. And it's a big surprise because we get that our transition amplitudes between states is completely real. That's one of these funny things which came to surprise to researchers, and it has something to do with summing over orientations. So what you will get is just 2 6J symbols and these dimension factors. And that gives you the transition amplitude between 2 such states.
two dependencies are, one is prime, the other is an unprime.
Oh, so these are actually different. I think I did it wrong in the notes. I have to correct it in the notes. One is what? So there's a mistake in the notes because I put just multiplied them together, forgetting some J indices. So this is these are the transition amplitudes. So one thing, it's they are real, which came as a bit surprise, you know. it has something to do with summing over orientations. And if you sum over orientation, you actually invert the minus in the action. So you actually get something which is rather cos of your action, which is real and is not a complex amplitude. Another thing is that it factorizes. You know, you can't find two orthogonal states here. So you get what you have is basically if you take the inner product between two states and you find that this is basically given by, you know, square root of the inner product, the norm basically of C1 and C2 and that holds for all states and that actually means that your Hilbert space or your vector space is one dimensional. Because you don't have any non-trivial interference terms here. You just have one vector, basically one physical vector. And that is related to the fact that the phase space for the sphere is zero-dimensional. It's actually only a point, or actually 2 points, because of the different orientations. the reduced phase space. It's different if you change the topology. So 3D gravity is not entirely empty, and in the homework you will have an example where the Hilbert space is not one-dimensional. So I'm already telling you some answer. You find one-dimensional for your Hilbert space, it's the wrong answer. It factorizes. And we can compute. We can take one of these spin networks, say the left one or the right one. It's also, you see, it's completely time symmetric. You know, usually you would say this is a transition amplitude from something happening here and then later happening here. Does not matter at all. So here it's completely without type ordering. So we take this one of these tetrahedral spin networks, we take all spin networks to spins to zero. That means we take the constant state, 1, and we compute, basically I forgot to put here projectors, we compute the transition between a state which is nothing so it's not an empty universe because it's not a universe it's nothing it's a state where all geometrical operators which you can build from the fluxes have exact expectation value, zero, and no fluctuation at all in your triad variables or in your fluxes, and all the holonomies have expectation value zero, which is really funny because the holonomies are usually just unitary operators, but the fluctuations are basically in the holonomies are kind of maximal. So because there's no geometry here, you could call it nothing. And this would be basically the transition from something, a point, to, you know, not literally a tetrahedron, to something where if you measure, say, six geodesics, you know, they have this given length given by the spins. So this you need to see as embedded in a sphere and imagine that you measure six geodesics. And the result is you get the six J symbol. So this is, you know, I'm telling you a bit nonsense. This is the creation probability of a probability of a 3D universe. And I could tell you much more things. This actually already gives you the so-called Ponzano-Reggie path integral model. You know, from that on, this is actually the amplitude which you give to a chunk of space. You know, to build a bigger chunks of space, you glue these chunks of space together and you integrate over the boundary variables. And that gives you the path integral for which is called Ponzano-Reggie model. So if I would have more time, I would have basically actually shown you the path integral, and you would have seen that you get basically this thing. And interestingly, this is basically also called the Hartle-Hawking no-boundary wave function. This gives you actually the physical wave function for a chunk of space, and you can see that as giving you the probability to create a universe from nothing, and pops out. And for, you know, I mean, you can make these J's huge. So there's a finite probability in principle to go from nothing to huge. And you can make it small, opposite orientation, you mean?
No, opposite, from something to nothing.
Yeah, it's also opposite because everything is a matrix, so there's also a finite probability that the 3D universe will vanish, or the 4D universe. No, these things happen, like meteorites. Fortunately, only in Siberia. I don't know, you know. or unfortunately for the Siberian people. So, okay. So basically, this gives you the amplitude. Actually, I feel my personal impression is one could much more work on this interpretation of what it means. So one can play around with this. And this is a zero-dimensional theory, so you can already do some stuff there. As I told you, if you go to a torus already, it's a bit more difficult, a torus for technical reason, or genus, higher genus, you get a finite-dimensional Hilbert space. you get actually infinite-dimensional Hilbert space, but it's a finite-dimensional phase space. And you will see basically a much more simplified example in the homework, where you solve the theory on a torus for structure group Z2. for that too, you have just much easier, easier time to write things actually. Okay, so that I guess closes the lecture. So I won't give, I don't think that I give another lecture here, but there will be the script appearing at some point if you have questions about 4D. So I can say 5 words about 4D. There's a canonical theory and there's this covariant theory. So I haven't told you anything about covariant theory. But canonical theory, if you are interested in reading these things, all what I told you, almost all what I told you, is the same in 4D. So you have the same kind of gauge variables. They are called Ashtika variables. You also quantize them as fluxes. The only difference is that fluxes are now integrated over surfaces and not over edges. But you have also holonomies. And you don't have a natural length operator, but a natural area operator. And then you have a volume operator and these things. The big difference is the dynamics, as you can guess. It's not the flatness constraints. It's a more complicated combination and contraction of flatness constraints. And the algebra of these constraints is much more complicated. I've written it actually in the script, in this interludium part. And this is a big problem in having these very complicated constraints. And you can't solve them in this nice way in which we have done it here. Because here we just use the flatness constraints with this trivial algebra where you know you just needed to write a delta function of these things. And the other big difference is whereas you can discretize here, and you don't need to really think much about this discretization. In 4D, you can also discretize. But things will depend on the discretization. In 3D, it does not depend on the discretization. In 4D, it will depend on the discretization. And then you have to think what to do with this discretization. And my personal work is busy to do actually some renormalization with this discretization to get rid of this discretization again so that you really have a quantization of your full continuum theory. So what I wanted to tell you is that all the technical stuff which you would have to learn for 4D, you already learned in the 3D theory. What is different is basically the dynamical constraints. So you have to replace the flatness constraint with some contraction of the flatness constraints. And I've actually written them already in the script, if you have a look. And then the quantization of these things is a bit more complicated because in this case, you really take these constraints and try to quantize them, you know, directly, not with this thing we know what these things generate. Okay. So thank you. If you have more questions, I will be in my office from time to time.
Thank you very much for your wonderful lectures, for your three dimensional lectures, and for creating the universe for us in the end. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
thank
this
you
is
for
a small
your help.
Present for you.
Thanks.